I'm Dawn Durham, and welcome to Patent Pod. When we think about promoting pro-social student behaviors, we need to first look at our own behaviors as the educator in the classroom. We want to ask the question, are the behaviors I display as the teacher in the room culturally responsive? Joining us today to help us navigate culturally responsive classroom management is the founder of My Reflections Matter, Chime Morales-James. Chime, thank you for joining us today via Zoom. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start off pretty generic here. Let's just talk about the reason as to why we have to have this conversation. When we think about the data collected, statistically speaking, what do we know about our current classroom management practices across the field?
So, you know, when I think about classroom management, especially when I talk about culturally responsive classroom management, most folks kind of get stuck on the very technical aspects of classroom management. Mm-hmm. So when I say technical, I'm thinking about like the employment of PBIS practices, token economy systems, behavior charts, all those kinds of things that teachers like to add in their toolboxes. And that's great. And I think that sometimes there's a need for that. But when I'm talking about culturally responsive classroom management, I'm really trying to shift the focus away from changing a child's behavior to asking what is it about the adult behavior that needs to be modified. And I don't think that's a conversation that in most classroom management, professional development, teachers are having enough opportunity to engage in. So really for me, classroom management is about cultivating a democratic classroom culture and a climate where that really situates students as the leaders in their learning, and the adults are more of the facilitators in helping them meet their learning needs. It's a really different philosophy around engaging students. And I think that until schools and those who work in them begin to really shift their mindsets around what learning and education can look like, and I'm putting in air quotes, behavioral issues, will always be a thing, because the truth is that the kids that teachers are having the most issues with are the ones that have checked out. They're the ones that refuse to buy into what schools are selling to them. And usually that's the idea that you cannot grow up to be a contributing member of our society without adults telling you what to learn, when, how, and where. And that the learning process is something done to you rather than learning is a process someone does. Mm-hmm. So I just don't think that most classroom management conversations in higher education or in professional development workshops are looking at that.
I think that's an interesting point, because now that you say that, if I reflect back to my own schooling and my own professional development work that I've attended, I think you're it's pretty spot on. We don't really talk about the culture, climate, and behaviors as a whole. We really kind of isolate and talk about, a ticket system, like you had said, or how to get them to line up nice and neatly in a hallway, or, kind of these, and please understand, those are all very important pieces in a school setting. In any setting, you need to have, the norms and what's appropriate and what's not appropriate behaviors, and we're not disregarding that. But the larger piece is what I hear you saying, and the conversation you want folks to be having is, what is, as a climate, what's the kind of behaviors we're all engaging in and the philosophies we're all engaging in that would promote the understanding of engagement and students wanting to be engaged in the learning process? Am I understanding this correctly?
Absolutely right. And then when we talk about, Black and brown kids, and we look, especially when we look at nationally, the outcomes for predominantly Black and brown children in schools, we know is abysmal. It's always been abysmal. And so, when we talk about classroom management, I feel like the tendency when we talk in terms of how that relates to Black and brown children, there's more of a tendency for people to become even more strict in their thinking and their philosophy around how we manage Black and brown kids. We need to police them, get more security guards in. We need a resource officer that I can call into my classroom when I have a kid who's quote unquote out of control or quote unquote disrespectful, because those are usually the kinds of behaviors that Black and brown children, particularly our Black and brown Latino boys, are getting in trouble for, right?
Which
is all based on, an adult's perspective on what they deem is normal and appropriate behavior in a school or a classroom.
Okay. I think you're making some good points here that we need to be thinking about. What do we know as kind of what's been done in the past and how do we take that information and strengthen and enhance ourselves as educators and our districts and our school teams to move forward with this idea of culturally responsive classroom management. I want to pivot for a minute. When we talk about, you know, we talk a lot, when we say classroom management, we oftentimes think about, as you had said, the kids' behaviors. But I really want to focus right now on educator behaviors. And there are four behaviors that educators engage in to really promote a culturally responsive classroom. Could you help us out with those four behaviors?
Sure. And I would add that there's definitely more than four. And I'll talk about a few of those, or at least the ones that I see that are the, probably the most challenging, but have the best rewards in the end, right?
Okay.
Usually when I work with teachers, I'll often ask them, like, what do you believe is the most, you know, the number one most effective classroom management strategy? And, you know, they'll start listing all those technical strategies that we just talked about. And then I'll ask them, you know, I want you to think about your favorite teacher and think about what were all the qualities that made that teacher so fabulous. And they'll, you know, shout out things like, you know, they were kind, they were empathetic to my needs, you know, they were fun and exciting, they were humorous, funny. They list all of these things that have nothing to do with all of the technical strategies that they listed around classroom management. And really what this boils down to is relationships. So, and all the research, I mean, there's plenty of research out there that has proven and shown that relationships really are the number one classroom management or proactive classroom management strategy that teachers can employ in their classroom. The trick is, you know, not everyone is really good at developing relationships. We have adults that can't even develop good relationships with their peers, and they're in classrooms trying to work with kids when they haven't been successful in even developing relationships with their own counterparts. So to me, relationships is at the core. You know, if kids see us like family, how are they going to treat us? They're going to treat us like family.
Sure.
Learning happens because they feel connected to us. They see us as a human because we show that we see them as human beings in our classroom. And this is particularly important for Black and Brown students because they will work for relationships more than they will for things. And so when we think about, I argue that that's the case probably for just humans in general. You know, we work for relationships, for human connections more than we do for things. But when we think about culturally across the world, and actually Zaretta Hammond is a great resource for folks. I highly recommend folks to read her book. It's titled Culturally Responsive Teaching in the Brain. And Zaretta Hammond talks about this. She mentions that in most European cultures, they're rooted in more of an individualistic mindset, while the collectivist worldview is more of a common practice among Latin America, Asian, African American, or African, Middle Eastern, and many Slavic cultures as well. So probably about 80 to 90% of the world really functions from more of a collectivist mindset, the idea that we are communal, that we problem solve together, that, you know, working, or, you know, learning isn't something that happens in isolation, it happens with people. But when we go into American classrooms, what's the mindset typically, right? The mindset is, you know, kids are expected to learn on their own. I mean, when we get graded, we're not graded as a collective, we're graded as an individual. Everything that we do in schools is based on an individual. And so when you have most folks across the world who are being raised in families and communities that don't think that way, that becomes a cultural conflict in classrooms. And it isn't about what's right or wrong. I'm not saying that folks that have an individualistic mindset are wrong. I'm saying that there are different ways to which people learn, and that most people don't actually learn in that way. However, we have set up a schooling system that functions from an individualistic mindset.
So,
that causes a lot of behavioral issues. Right?
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that we're talking about this, because when you think about that and you kind of bring it to the forefront and say, well, yeah, actually, that's exactly kind of what's happening in our school setting, traditionally speaking, you know, and kind of shifting away from that, understanding that, as you had said, the majority of people out there, of our families out there, or the cultures out there are really more of a collecticism kind of an ideal. We can obviously see where there's a conflict.
Yeah. And you know, that probably, you know, I think of sort of like the American philosophies, like, you know, you pick up your, what is it, what's the the phrase that people use, you pick yourself up by your bootstraps, right? Mm-hmm. That's the idea that, you know, if you get somewhere, you get there because you, not anyone else, had anything to do with it. You on your own worked really hard to get there. And the reality is almost no one gets to be successful without people.
Absolutely.
Without at least one other person in their life that has influenced them or supported them in some kind of way, directly or indirectly. But for some reason, we have fallen into this myth that's something that happens, and it's not true.
So when we think about those behaviors, you know, you're really talking about that building of relationships is a huge behavior for us educators in the classroom. Is, you know, that's step one. You know, you have to have, and I think most folks would absolutely say, yeah, you have to like your kids, you got to love them, you got to have a good relationship. But it's going deeper than just knowing their name. You know, it's knowing about the child. It's knowing about their family dynamic, as everyone's family's dynamic is different and certainly has an impact on what's happening in the classroom during the school day. So it's more than just this kind of surface level relationship. You're really talking about digging in and making connections with each child, as that's what they're seeking. And when they have that connection, that's when we're going to get the great learning outcomes.
Absolutely. So, like, you know, relationship building is like the big one, right? And then there are all these, like, behaviors that teachers engage in that help them to actually build connections with people. And, you know, one of those is that, you know, teachers take on, you know, culturally responsive teachers take on a salutogenic versus a pathogenic perspective in their teaching practices. So what I mean by that is that they're solutions-based, they are asset-based, they see they look at the strengths of their students. You know, they don't pathologize their kids. So if they see a behavior, they're not blaming the child for that behavior or their culture or where they came from or their home or their family or their community. They really take time to kind of focus on, how do I get to the root of what's happening? Because what I'm seeing is the tip of the iceberg, right?
Sure.
This behavior, there's something deeper going on. And so instead of me putting the blame on the kid, right, how can I kind of pause and reflect on my own beliefs, my own behaviors that perhaps might be contributing to this outcome, or maybe there's something outside of this classroom that's impacting my child. They haven't come out yet, so I've been working on, I'm calling them You Matter flashcards. They're You Matter cards, and it's really a self-reflective exercise for young people to engage in when there's, you know, behavioral issues that pop up. Because I get it. Like, stuff happens in classes, and kids have been in school for a long time and have, you know, unfortunately been, you know, conditioned to think that they have to wait for someone to tell them what to do. And if they come into a classroom where a teacher's philosophy is very the opposite, you know, that teacher still may face some behavioral issues and some pushback because students aren't used to that. So it might take some time for them adjusting to that. And so the You Matter cards, which should be coming out in the next few months in 2019, really is a way where a teacher can kind of just, when there's an issue, instead of addressing it, which sometimes teachers will do sometimes, they want to solve the issue in that moment, and they end up engaging this sort of like power struggle with the student. Yep. Instead of doing that, you put the deck of cards on a student's desk, and through those cards, there are a series of questions that students can reflect on. You know, what's going on? You know, the behavior displaying, you know, does it have something to do? Like, do you need something? Have you not eaten today? If you haven't eaten, feel free to go to the snack drawer in my room, you know, and get what you need. Is there something happening at home that you want to talk about? Or maybe you need to talk to someone else outside of this classroom. Use this card as a pass to see your guidance counselor, whatever it is.
Sure.
They're not totally finished, but I will send you a link once they're up.
That would
be wonderful.
Once the flashcards
are up.
Thank you.
Yeah,
really
but the idea, because I remember as a teacher how that was, and I remember as much as my philosophy was very different than perhaps sort of the mainstream philosophy on education, there was still stuff I had to deal with. You know, there were still kids who were coming in my class angry because they had a really bad experience in the previous teacher's classroom.
Absolutely.
And
they carry it with
them. My class.
Yep.
They carry it with them. And so, So culturally responsive teachers take on that lens. They recognize that I need to pause. I need to kind of figure out, how do I get to the root of a behavior instead of filling out a detention slip, filling out a behavioral referral form. That's a last resort. Usually culturally responsive teachers have gone through several different steps before they resort to something like that, which is very rare, right?
Yeah. Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah, no. Yeah. I would also say that, you know, another behavior that teachers, culturally responsive teachers engage in is they really create an environment that's physically affirming and emotionally safe. So when I say physically affirming, I'm thinking about, you know, how do teachers, you know, how do kids see themselves in your, in represented in your own classroom? Just even like the physical space, like do kids see themselves? What, you know, what kinds of images are on the wall? Do they perpetuate negative stereotypes about different groups of people in our society? The books that you have in your library in the corner of your room, do your kids see their, themselves? Do they see their stories represented in the books? You know, those are the kinds of things that, you know, when a child enters the classroom, it's the first thing they see is your space.
Yeah.
And a lot of times we don't often think about that. You know, we hang up stuff and, you know, I sometimes I'll have teachers kind of do walkthroughs in their buildings, in their classrooms. And when they come back, they're like, oh my God, I didn't realize, like, you know, we serve mostly black and brown kids here, but almost like everything on their wall, on the walls represent white children, you know, or white able children or, you know, so yeah, this is something that, I think teachers need to think about. Is how does their physical space speak to their kids? How does it represent them? Do they see themselves there?
And I think that's a good point. And you had said, I think when you realize it, you kind of look back in your classroom and you go, oh, okay, now I see where this was going. Because you just, you know, by no harm, you know, no thought to hurt children, you just kind of do it and you don't realize. And then when you reflect on that.
You don't think about it.
Exactly. And you kind of have this new perspective and this new lens of which to look at. And one of the things I want to just draw back to those behaviors, you know, relationship building, top of the list, no doubt, a little bit deeper than just that surface, you know, saying hi to a kid in the hallway, digging really deeper into building that relationship. You talked a lot about self-reflection, not only in engaging self-reflection, but in promoting self-reflection for the students. When you have a student who is in complete meltdown mode, and we have all had kiddos who have been in complete meltdown mode from 5-year-olds all the way up to 18-year-olds. And sometimes their meltdowns are quite scary, you know, for both them and for the adult in the room. But to really, you know, promote that engaging of self-reflecting, you know, tell me what is going on. Think about it. What's really at the base of this meltdown you're having? What's really at the base of this anger you're displaying here? Is it because I asked you to do the spelling test, or is it something deeper? Is there something else? And now you're just kind of taking it out at this time because this is the perfect opportunity for you to do that. So I heard you talk a lot about self-reflection. I also heard you talk a lot about that, the physical and emotional affirmations and the safety of the classroom and the physical and emotional setup of the classroom, and how that behavior of engaging in ensuring that my students see themselves in the room through a variety of ways, whether it be what's presented on the boards, the examples we use, the books we have in our classroom. You know, that's a behavior that a culturally responsive educator could engage in that says and already makes a huge shift for the kids in that classroom.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's a...
Go ahead.
So what I
want to ask, because this is something, you know, we've been talking a lot here in Pennsylvania about equitable practices. You know, we have a task force at the state level for equity. We're really looking at, you know, how do we promote equitable practices in our schools from all levels, to the from the building level, classroom level, building level, district level. And one of the things I want to ask is, you know, we have classrooms across the state that are rather homogeneous in nature. They are.
Yeah.
But that we still have to have the conversation, because there's still variabilities within that classroom that warrant us being culturally responsive. Would you not agree?
Absolutely.
I think sometimes we forget that.
We do forget that. I think that we, you know, it's funny because, like, when I go into schools, people will often say, they're like, oh, how is it that we can have, you know, disproportionate outcomes when all of our kids are black and brown? And I'm like, well, even within your student population, there's variability, right?
Yes.
Every white child isn't the same, doesn't come from the same background, doesn't have the same experiences. Every black child that, you know, isn't the same, they don't have the same experiences or have the same even cultural background. So, you know, people, maybe when we look at people physically, there's this assumption that somehow we have the same experiences when it's not true at all. Mm-hmm. And I would also argue that, you know, people will often say, well, culturally responsive practices are not necessary if you're working in predominantly white, you know, community. And I would argue absolutely not, because one, like you said, there's variability even within your white students. You have poor white students, you have middle to upper class white students, you have students that identify as LGBTQ, you have students that have disabilities. You know, there's variability within that. But also, when we talk about perspectives, worldview perspectives, even if there aren't as many worldview perspectives or cultural perspectives in the classroom, they are outside of that classroom.
Yes.
And so we do a disservice for white students when we don't provide them with opportunities to actually consider and think about the perspectives that other people might have outside of their community. How do they learn to empathize? How do they learn to work with people who don't look like them? How do they how do they learn to challenge the status quo that they don't even benefit from themselves, you know, in the long run, right? When we think about status quo and we think about who really benefits from a lot of our, you know, policies as a country, I just don't think that people think about it in that way. So it's important that we have change makers in our society, whether they're white, black, brown, regardless of what their background is. Students need to learn how to do that. And it's very important that we have white students that can be allies for folks of color that have been marginalized, and that they have conversations with their own folks about what's going on.
Sure.
'Cause that shouldn't be the burden of black and brown people to do that.
Do we need to all kind of take ownership of all of us being culturally responsive? And again, I'm glad we're talking about this, because we have folks across the state that might say that's not something that we need to worry about because look where we work. But that's not the case, because as you had said, I mean, I could take my own children. There's variabilities within my own two children. And, you know, they're from the same household and have the same family dynamic, but there are certainly variabilities in lots of different ways between the two of them. You know, think about that in a classroom of 25, 30 kids. You're going to have variabilities because every aspect of them is not the same as the kid next to them, no matter what race or ethnicity they're of.
Right.
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah. So this leads us into the question about schools seeking support. There are times, especially in the current day, where there are some significant demographic changes to the school level or the district level, and schools are seeking some support on how to be culturally responsive, how to respond to these demographic changes. What's some initial thoughts you have, or some initial assistance that you might offer them in regards to how to be responsive to these shifts in their classroom?
Yeah. You know, when I think about being responsive, or just thinking about, you know, because now, you know, everyone's jumping on the equity train, right? You know, how do we become more equitable in our practices? How can we be more culturally responsive? And for me, first and foremost, is that this really requires for school leaders and educators to be humble, you know, to humble themselves and really acknowledge that they haven't been responsive prior to now, which has led to the inequitable institutionalized outcomes that have been present and pervasive over time, even long before they even step foot in the door as leaders or teachers.
Sure.
Just like the restorative indigenous practices that many schools are now adopting in their schools, they need to really acknowledge the harm that they've done as an institution, ask for forgiveness, and ask those that they've harmed what they suggest needs to happen to repair what has been done, and actually do it. I think that is a step that people are totally missing the boat on when they talk about equity and cultural responsiveness. They skip that. They jump to, you know, let's figure out what are the things we can do. We can, you know, what are the practices we can change? Mm-hmm. Oh, great. I'll change my mindset, and, you know, my mindset will change my practices. That's great. But have you actually acknowledged that harm has been done? Mm-hmm. Have you asked for forgiveness? Have you publicly apologized to the students and families in your community that have been harmed as a result of practices and policies that have been in place for years and have harmed families for years?
Mm-hmm.
That is the first step before anything else. And that, I guarantee, will begin to, you know, break some of the barriers that a lot of educators are facing with a lot of the kids that they teach and the families whose children they're teaching.
So that's humble self-reflection.
People are angry.
Yeah,
people are angry. They don't trust the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say, though, I'm speaking specifically of black and brown families, or families that have been disenfranchised historically, they don't trust schools. Usually the parents and families have had the negative experiences with schooling, and they bring that in. And no one has ever validated that. No one has ever said, you know what? You're right. We didn't educate you in the way that you needed to be, you know, educated. We didn't provide a schooling experience that was equitable and affirming and loving. And we want to do right by that. And how do you then bring in those families to also be part of the problem solving? Because a lot of what we do is in schools is we close our doors as educators, as the quote-unquote professionals, and try to solve all these problems, and we never actually ask those who we serve what they want and need.
Yeah, that family engagement piece, you know, we can't leave that out, that, you know, those are the our families, our parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles, siblings, older and younger, are really the folks that are going to help us understand where we need to move forward, where we were, where we need to be, and where we're going to move forward, and how to do that through this self-reflection and being very humble. And, you know, just acknowledging mistakes were made, decisions were made that were not perhaps not the best of interest for all students involved. Accept it, acknowledge it, and how do we improve from that point on?
Yeah.
Excellent. Now, where can we go if we're looking for more information, not just on being culturally responsive classroom management, but just kind of culturally responsive in general? Where can we send folks to get some more information?
So folks can definitely visit my website. That's myreflectionmatters.org. So there's a resource library of culturally responsive educational products from curriculum, books, film, educational apps, et cetera, that folks can kind of, you know, look through, and they can click. It'll direct them to links to where they can actually get those resources. Also, I mean, there's also, I also put on workshops and professional development. So particularly around how do we support, as educators, how do we support Black and Brown children developing positive, healthy racial and ethnic identities? So folks can definitely on my website, if you click on services, you can learn more about the type of services that I offer for educators. But I also want to share some of, you know, my go-to places where I get my own professional development and resources. So some places that I love to go to are embracingrace.org is a great website that I highly encourage educators to who are looking to kind of unpack some of their conceptions around race in the classroom. Great resource. And they also have, I think, a podcast. Teaching Tolerance has some great resources as well. So I recommend folks. They have a publication that came out. I'm trying to remember what the name of it is. But there is a publication where they do talk about how teachers can cultivate classroom climate where that really embraces kids from various backgrounds. So I highly recommend checking out their publications there. I love, so Neonu Span and Associates. Neonu, I think, is out of Pennsylvania. She also does work in Connecticut. And she's popular for her Beyond Diversity 101 intensive. Usually they're about 5 days. So like schools will send, you know, a group of staff there. I've worked with folks where we've attended for 5 days, and it's really intense. They get deep down and personal, and it's really about unpacking, you know, our racial biases and examining how organizations perpetuate oppressive practices and how we can begin to dismantle that back in our own educational work environment. So I highly, you know, suggest folks check her out. That's Nionu Span, SPANN. And that's where I get my professional development done. I just recently had seen Dr. Joy DeGruy, DeGruy. She wrote Post Traumatic Slave Syndrome. Great book, great research that she did. I just went to a 2-day intensive with her here in Connecticut. I know she was in Princeton in June, so you may want to check out and see where she is in New Jersey next time. She's all over the country, but she's phenomenal. And she really does a great job at talking about the history of our country, but really the history that we haven't been told. And I think part of the problem is for us as teachers is that we haven't been told the truth about the history of our country. We haven't been told the truth about the history of various folks. And so when we don't know the truth, we come in with all these different misconceptions. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that influences how we connect or don't connect with people. Sure. So I highly recommend folks to kind of do, you know, figure out what kind of personal journey they need to take and connect with the folks that, that can help them and do some of the stuff. People's Institute for Survival and Beyond, another phenomenal organization that they do on doing racism. I don't know if you guys have brought that to Jersey yet, but their popular series on doing racism is also another good workshop series. And then there's the Center for Racial Justice, which is out of New York, and the NYU Metro Center, which is where I worked out of, and a lot of my work was influenced by the 10 years that I was there at NYU. So definitely check out NYU Metro Center.
Well, this is a great list. Yeah. Thank you very much. This is a wonderful list to be able to have. I'm trying to write down as fast as I can, so I can get them all. But this is what we don't want to have happen is for folks to hear this and then kind of turn around and be like, oh, okay, I heard it. It was a good 30 minutes. I'm good now. But we want them to go out to these resources and seek out more information. So I appreciate that you providing such an extensive list of where to go and why we should be thinking there or what they have to offer, because I think that helps folks out in the field understand, oh, there's might be a few things that I do need to kind of hone in on, and where should I be looking rather than just kind of doing this blanketed search for cultural responsive behaviors and you know, who knows what comes up. So I appreciate you giving an extensive list and a little bit more specific. Thank you for that. And thank you for allowing us to engage in this conversation with you. You know, this is something that we need to all be conversing about for the betterment of our students, for the betterment of our communities, for the betterment of the field in general. So I thank you so much for that, Jemai. And one of the things we strive for here at Patton is to really build this notion of we want to grow educationally for ourselves. We want to grow in our own professional knowledge. What advice might you offer to those in the field when they think about growing in a professional manner? What advice would you offer to them?
Get as much, I would say get out there. Go find, there are people out here that are doing this work, that have been doing it for a long time, and allow yourself to be vulnerable, to attend a lot of the trainings and workshops that I had mentioned, the folks that lead a lot of these trainings and workshops in the field. Mm-hmm. Be vulnerable, because there are going to be hard conversations, and you're going to have to look at yourself in a way that you've never looked at yourself and see things that you didn't want to look at about yourself. But I think that's what people need to do. They need to be more vulnerable and more willing to look at themselves in the mirror and face some truths that are uncomfortable to face. And I think that's the only way to be better at what we do when we're serving kids.
So really self-reflect, and it's okay to be a little uncomfortable at times, right? To be uncomfortable, Oh, I'm not sure this is a conversation I want to have. That's the conversation you want to be having. That's the conversation you need to be having. If it makes you feel uncomfortable, that's the one you need to engage in.
That's the sign. Yep.
Awesome. Well, Jemai, thank you again so very much. I appreciate it. And thank you to all of you in the field. You inspire educational growth in your students every day. A special thank you to John Ragsdale.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for being here with us. A special thank you to John Ragsdale for producing this podcast. We'll see you next time on Patton Pod.